had heard the whispers below. The Uskar were shocked at how well this strong young Uskar was performing, and how well he was surviving. "Where?" Aulan asked, fishing out a different crystal. "Just my hands tonight," said Badlan, holding forth his hands, his fingers all bloodied and nicked from hammering all day on the stones. Aulan took them in her own, and fell into the magic of the crystal, and was soon imparting magical warmth into the young man. She was feeding him, she was healing him, and she was sharing his smiles when both needed them. "Do not come to me on Lisbeth's night," Badlan said to her, as they sat there holding hands, his voice very serious. "Promise me." Aulan sighed, but nodded. "Unless they let me fetch you before moonrise, and bring you to the safety of the camp." He nodded his agreement, but they both knew she'd never convince the Uskar to do any such thing. They didn't care if the Fossa ate this stupid Umus, as they didn't care if he worked himself to death. They simply didn't care. Badlan headed back to the slave caves soon after, and Aulan bid him farewell. She didn't dare follow, for that was too near to Elder Raybert. She wanted to go to Kreas Adiad, which was only up over that one last rise, but she knew that she had been out too long already. She moved off the way, scrambling through some brush to come to a cliff face, then called upon her magical ring once more, and leapt away, and flew, joyous and free, down the darkened side of Firaxbuer. Too soon after, she sat down just outside the Uskar camp, and crept to the back of the tent that she had once shared with Shona, but now was hers alone. Glancing around, confident that she hadn't been seen, Aulan went in through a secret flap she had cut in the back of the tent. A light came up as soon as she entered, the hood removed from a burning lantern. The man who had claimed her to become his bride, Te Orlig, was in there waiting for her, sitting comfortably, staring at her with smug contentment. Aulan sucked in her breath, expecting to be beaten. What was he doing in here? He had claimed her, but they hadn't been proclaimed in marriage yet, and were not sharing this tent. Te Orlig hadn't even touched her since making the claim. Was that about to change? Aulan grew even more uneasy. She had only one sexual encounter with a man, 3 years before, when Breyth had raped her. Looking at Te Orlig, the Uskar Lauch, the war leader, so always on the edge of anger, she realized that she would much rather be beaten. "Oh, but my surprise," he said. "I had to relieve—" "Shut up. You've been gone the whole of the night." Aulan swallowed hard. She told herself that she was a woman now, not a girl, and reminded herself that she had power, magical power, and now carried the gemstones to use it, if necessary. "Have you made it your duty to spy on me, then?" she asked, stepping into the room with as much confidence as she could manage. She didn't want him to see her fear. She understood men like Te Orlig all too well. They only grew emboldened and meaner when they knew that people were frightened of them. "Aye," he answered simply, and that stopped Aulan in her tracks. She stood there, mouth hanging open, staring at him. "I have claimed you as my wife. Any woman would be glad of that." Aulan nodded, not about to argue. She understood the ways of Uskar, whether she liked them or not. It wasn't her place to question, and she couldn't deny that almost every woman in the tribe would be thrilled to have Te Orlig, perhaps the most powerful man in the tribe, as a husband. Nor could Aulan deny the many jealous looks that had come her way since the war leader's surprising claim the previous summer, immediately after the proper mourning period for Breyth had ended. Aulan wasn't considered especially beautiful among the Uskar, and was actually the smallest woman in the tribe. Although there were many whispers that she was next in line to join the coven, who knew what might happen in the months, years, decades even, between now and the next opening among the 13 witches of Uskar.
Where were you?
Out.
And the camp? With another man?
No.
With the Eumus?
No, of course not.
Then where?
He leapt up from his seat and stormed over to tower above her, leering down in open threat.
You will tell me.
In the forest, she replied, trying to remain steady. On the mountainside. I go out all the time, almost every night.
Where? He demanded.
I would know every valley, every tree, every cave, she said, improvising. When I was with Breyeth in battle, my spirit nearly lost its way. Had I known better the area where he fought, perhaps...
She let her voice trail off, and looked down at the floor,
but took some secret comfort in seeing Teorlig's feet slide back a bit.
Aulin looked up quickly, locking his eyes.
I will not fail my man again, she said.
His face became a mask of confusion, intrigue, pride, all sorts of emotions, but none of them clearly negative.
Aulin knew she had distracted him. To know the mountain is to know Uskar, she went on, now with confidence. The god's song is not steady, but ebbs and flows in different places, like streams of magic. I will know those streams better than any.
Teorlig didn't answer, didn't blink.
Are any stronger than Teorlig?
Aulin asked him.
No.
And so none shall be stronger than his wife in the ways of magic. Anything less would not be acceptable.
He nodded, and seemed to be digesting that. But his demeanor changed suddenly, and he came forward, painfully grabbing Aulin by the chin and yanking her face in line with his steely gaze.
You are destined for the coven, and soon to be my wife.
Yet you take such chances? No chances, she insisted.
You could fall in a ravine.
She brought her hand up, holding the cat's eye crystal.
I see as well as in daylight.
You threaten your place on the coven.
Aulin shook her head emphatically,
as much as she could against his iron grip.
The Uskarigin has no edicts against wandering the mountain in the night.
None, other than good sense.
I am not afraid. It makes me stronger. Do you not wish that?
He was trying to stay angry here, but Aulin knew that her appeal and promise of strength had walked around his fury. And the only lie she had told was that she had indeed been with an Umus. But he never questioned the lie, because no one could have gone that far up Firoxbuer and returned before the night was half through. The rest of her story had been true. She was going out in order to become stronger, for she had found secrets that not even the coven, blinded by their old rituals and etiquette with the crystals, could hope to realize. She was indeed getting stronger.
But not for Teorlig's benefit. You take care on your paths. We wouldn't want you to come to harm.
Teorlig warned with a toothy grin and a brief tightening of her wrist.
And knew that if your foolishness cost you your place in the coven, you will be shunned by all men. And I will not marry you, but will take you often for my pleasure and your pain.
He let go of her chin and reversed his hand, using the back of his fingers to stroke her cheek, but so awkwardly, almost as if he had only heard that that was how lovers touched. So clearly there was something out of sorts here, but Aulin couldn't quite place it. It was as if there was no desire in the man beyond his hunger for power. Even with the threat he had issued, Aulin understood clearly that it was only half true, that he wouldn't take her for his pleasure. He would take her to punish her, to satisfy his anger, not any carnal desire. She was quite relieved when he left, particularly when she realized that she was still wearing the ring she'd fashioned of moonstone and malachite and wound with wedstone threading.
If Meron found out that Aulan had broken sacred crystals to get at the flakes within, it would cost Aulan more than a place among the coven. She intended to go back into the caverns beneath Kresedird, perhaps the very next night, but not in the way that Meron would send her there, for her heresy. 28. When you fear, charge. Talmadge crouched behind a tree, peering through a bush to watch the man standing in the stony shallows of the river. He appeared to be a few years younger than Talmadge, and not as tall, but he was clearly a bearman, a man of haunts, and no one Talmadge wanted to fight with, the veteran frontiersman knew when the stranger stripped off his shirt. This one was a warrior, no doubt about it, with a torso thick with muscles, but otherwise lean, and arms that looked as if they could break Talmadge in half. He moved with grace, too, and even when he reached back for something in his ample pack, his legs shifted subtly, perfectly, to keep him in balance, to keep him ready. It wasn't just the man himself that had Talmadge holding back cautiously. A most remarkable bow leaned on the pack, and a long sword as well. And though the blade was hidden in the sheath, the handle and pommel spoke of incredible workmanship. The man splashed himself quickly and repeatedly, then brought his cupped hands up to douse his head with the cold mountain water, rising and shaking vigorously. "Are you planning to lie there all day and just watch me?" he asked then, turning to glance in Talmadge's direction. Talmadge reflexively ducked away, rolling onto his back to put himself fully behind the tree. "As you wish," came the call, and Talmadge knew he had been seen. "I've some fine food to share," the stranger offered. After a few heartbeats, Talmadge dared peek around the other side of the tree. There stood the stranger, his shirt back on, holding a water skin he had apparently just filled. Notably, he hadn't retrieved his weapons, and he seemed wholly unconcerned with Talmadge. A moment later he glanced back, locking stares, and waved, winked, and smiled. "I will leave you to your river, friend," he called, "though it seems big enough and deep enough. Surely it's filled with enough fish for us both, yes?" Talmadge felt rather silly then. He climbed to his feet and moved out around the tree, towards the stranger, who smiled widely. "Who are you who comes out so far from the Tamed Lands?" Talmadge asked. "No farther than you," the stranger replied. "I've not seen you at matinee." "Likely not, as I don't even know what that is." Talmadge stopped his approach. "So's my point," he answered. "All who are out here from the Land of Haunts know of matinee." The man looked down to regard himself and held out his hands in a shrug. "Not all, I expect." "Then you are new here," said Talmadge. "I've not been this far south in many years," he replied, "and never on this side of the mountains. Then I ask again, who are you?" The man paused, then gave a little snort. "Is that a difficult question?" The stranger chuckled. "No, it's just..." He sighed, gave a self-deprecating laugh and straightened. "I am... Brian Marowee, of Dundalus." "Marowee? A strange name." "An Alfar name," the man said with a laugh. Talmadge rocked back on his heels a bit. "Elves? This stranger claimed a name from the elves?" "Alfar?" he echoed. "Aye, to El Alfar." Now it was Talmadge's turn to snort, to which the stranger merely shrugged. "It is as good a name as any," he explained. "And so it is one I choose to wear. And not the name your father gave you?" "I did not know my father." "Not really." "Your mother, then?" The man who called himself Brian Marowee nodded. "She gave you a name, and not an Alfar name?" "Yes, and no." "And it is not one I choose to wear." "I insist," Talmadge said. But the stranger simply laughed, then sighed, and began packing up his belongings.
"This is not a land for uninvited men who choose no proper introduction," Talmadge warned.
The man looked up from his pack.
"Pray tell me, who out here was ever invited?
And now you would lay claim to the place?"
"I did not say that."
"But you just built a wall of condition, yes? Tell you my name, or..."
"Or what?"
"Be banished."
"Do you intend to banish me?"
Talmadge licked his lips nervously.
"I only wish to offer advice."
"Offer your own name instead," said Brian.
"I'm known as Talmadge."
The man nodded.
"Greetings then, Talmadge. My offer of food stands. Am I to trust a man who will not tell me his true name?"
"My true name is that which I choose to wear.
And yes, you should trust me. I did not kill you where you lay by the tree, did I?"
Talmadge looked from the man, who was still 20 paces away, back to the tree, which was more than 20 paces back, then turned back with a doubtful expression to find Marowi laughing and gathering up his things. He lifted his sword belt and began to strap it on.
"This would be a lot more pleasant if you simply trusted me," Brian said. "I am not in the habit of walking up to strangers with my hands empty and open."
"But I didn't kill you."
Again Talmadge gave a doubting look,
or started to, for Marowi dived to the ground, into a roll, and came up so easily, and in steady balance to one knee, now with his bow in hand, and with his quiver right beside his hip, in easy reach.
And by the time Talmadge had even realized the movement, or the quiver, Marowi had drawn and knocked an arrow. A curious trio of feathers at its top, separating as the shaft bent.
The blood drained from Talmadge's face as that arrow shot off, sped right past him, so close that he could hear the hum of the fletching as it zipped by.
Talmadge stumbled aside, then managed to get into a crouch that he might dive aside if necessary.
But Brian had already set down the bow.
Talmadge glanced back, and was strangely unsurprised to see the arrow sticking into the ground right where he had poked his head around the tree.
There was nothing to doubt, then.
"Are you coming along?" Brian said,
drawing Talmadge from his shock.
"I am desperately hungry."
The crying grew louder, along with denials, then pleas for mercy.
Ineva tried to block it out,
for she understood what was happening in a tree cave farther along the Umas Grove.
"No, I will, I will,"
she heard.
And it was just gibberish now, the poor girl's voice breaking into shrieks of stinging pain.
"No, don't."
And the scream, probably the last one, to be followed by a night of unending sobbing, Ineva knew. The woman leaned back against the trunk of the pine tree that centered her residence, and closed her eyes, trying not to relive the experience. For she, too, had had such a visit from a witch, twice before over the years. The poor girl down the grove had become thick with the child of a rapist, half Uskar. Down at the lake villages, when a woman was caught in a raid and then released, was found to be pregnant, the villagers accepted the fate and welcomed the child. But not here, not with the Uskar. Any child with half Uskar and half Lakeman blood was an abomination that could never be allowed to draw breath. And thus the pregnant woman would be visited by the coven witch, overseeing the Umas. Now a vicious, sharp-featured and thin-haired woman named Kaya. Kaya took great pleasure in her duties, especially when those duties elicited screams like those coming down the grove this awful night. Ineva almost laughed as she considered that. Such an attitude certainly didn't make Kaya any worse than the others. A noise behind her had the woman turning about. It was too dark for her to make out details, but she knew that the figure crawling toward her was a niece, the closest woman she could call a friend.
"They are monsters," a niece said as she crawled up beside Ineva and wrapped the woman in a hug.
Ineva just squeezed her tighter, and said not a word. But what might she say?
It was amazing that Iniver hadn't been thrown from a cliff or into that awful chasm the Uskar thought the physical mouth of their demon god. She was not young and tender now, after all, and she knew of no other women who had been kept around to her age. When she had been brought here, a lifetime ago, 18 years, there had been a couple of Uma's women slightly older than her. They were long dead. Perhaps it was because of Baglan, she mused. He was still alive, up on the mountain, working himself to death, no doubt. The vile Uskar probably used Iniver to keep Baglan in line. At that terrible moment, Iniver didn't think that a good thing. Perhaps it would be better if Baglan just ran off, even if he was killed in the attempt. And yes, she would prefer death. Right then, she realized, and the heartbreaking sobs began from the poor young girl. Those sobs cut straight to Iniver's heart.
Talmadge watched the stranger, Brian Marowee, closely throughout dinner and afterward, as the man stretched out on a flat stone to regard the stars above. Brian hadn't asked many questions, nor had he offered many answers.
So, you've never been west of the mountains,
Talmadge said, after a long while of silence, trying to start a conversation. This region, northeast of Matanee, where the rivers flowed cold and strong out of the mountains, had become Talmadge's favourite hunting ground over the last couple of years, since he had stopped going to the mountain plateau far in the west. He often went by the spot where Chote had rescued him from the three thieves, past the grave of the fourth.
He could envision her so clearly, sliding in among them on her back, her legs working with devastating kicks.
A sad smile crossed the man's face before he focused again on this most curious and dangerous stranger. Brian lay back on the stone, smoking a long-stemmed pipe, blowing rings and watching the stars. The man had drawn his sword earlier to trim a log they used as a bench seat for their dinner. What warrior would use his sword for such a task? But Brian hadn't cared at all, and he had no reason to, Talmadge came to understand, as that magnificent blade, gleaming and with not a speck of tarnish or a nick to be found, easily chopped the branches. Talmadge had no idea of what metal might be in that sword, but he knew that he'd never before seen its equal. Even Redshanks couldn't claim such a blade.
Far to the north, Brian answered. West of them up there, in the lands known as the Barbican, but not here. I told you that earlier. But now you're here. How far south will you—
I just buried my mother,
Brian interrupted, cutting Talmadge short. The frontiersman stuttered with that for a few moments, then said meekly, I am sorry. Brian shrugged. She wasn't that old, but I knew she'd die young. She went peacefully. And unafraid.
I lost my whole family some 20 years or so ago, Talmadge said.
Brian turned suddenly and sat up.
She wasn't old, but oh, the life she lived, he began, suddenly perking up. Her name was known throughout Hans the Bear, and carried into Alpinador, and even Beren. Not one in 10,000 folk could have lived a life as rich as hers. So full.
Then that is a good thing.
Aye, though I miss her every day.
It is good that you were close. Your memories—
She saved my life, Brian went on, staring down at his own feet dangling from the side of the stone.
Saved my soul, perhaps. Though that one's needing more than just saving, I fear.
So you've come here?
He looked up curiously.
What?
No. Well, yes, I suppose. I had to go somewhere, and this place seemed better than the other side of the mountains.
You've been there, though. To Hans the Bear.
Brian Marowee laughed then, suddenly and from his belly, and Talmadge rocked back.
Aye, the other man said, and if I had half the courage many believe, I'd go again, on bended knee. So might that I'm a coward, or might that I'm just not ready.
It was a difficult time in Hont.
Brian laughed.
You were an outlaw?
The man laughed harder. My new friend Talmadge. If only you knew.
Talmadge rested back farther against the tree and tried to sort that out.
And why are you here? Brian asked.
I live here, all about these lands.
Why?
It was a simple question, or was it? As he considered his answer, it occurred to Talmadge that the roads of his life had narrowed considerably, ordered by ghosts. He didn't want to go back to the wilder lands, or past them to Hons, but neither could he bring himself to go west any longer, to the place he had once loved. A ghost had kept him from that mountain plateau before, and so now again, but this time it was entirely different.
A single word poses such a puzzle, Brian said, drawing Talmadge from his contemplations.
What?
Why?
Talmadge held up his hands in surrender.
It would seem that I am a bigger coward than you.
Do tell.
I should be going west now, down this very river, and to a place I would have one day called home, perhaps,
Talmadge explained, speaking more to himself than to his companion. But there I lost a woman I loved, taken by a monster.
His voice trailed away.
To get the pearls? Brian asked,
and Talmadge nodded.
And then the man's eyes opened wide indeed.
Brian Marowee laughed at him and hopped down from the stone.
A friend's told me, he said.
Of course I know the tale of Talmadge.
You are in the ballad, sir, called out in the songs of the bards.
What bards?
Talmadge stuttered.
In the wilder lands.
But you said you'd never been this far south in many years.
Brian shrugged.
I've not.
But your friend has.
It would seem so.
And you know, those bards are not known to be secret keepers.
Quite the opposite, I am told.
Talmadge scowled at the sarcasm.
But fear not, secret Talmadge, for they probably get most of your tale wrong.
As he spoke, Brian picked up his weapon belt and hitched it around his waist, then picked up that magnificent bow.
Talmadge shrank back. He was too far away to hope to get near the man in time to prevent a killing shot, and no, so suddenly once more, he had no idea of what this stranger intended.
I'm to the river to fetch some water, Brian explained, wearing a smirk that told Talmadge he had seen the man's uneasiness.
I found a few rather large bears down there.
He held up the bow.
You can come if you wish.
Talmadge, still flustered by the surprising revelation, didn't immediately answer, and then just shook his head.
You are welcome to stay the night in my camp, Brian told him. We can cut you a pipe of your own.
He gathered up the water skin and started away.
Talmadge sat there for a long while, not knowing what to do. Part of him wanted to run off into the night, to be as far away from this dangerous and potentially mad stranger as quickly as possible.
He slowly rose, thinking to do just that, when he noted Brian's huge pack. He looked all around, then made for it, peering out beyond it to make sure that the man was nowhere about. He pulled open the ties and threw back the flap, fumbling about in the clothing and tightly wrapped foodstuffs. And then, Talmadge's jaw dropped open as he brought forth a breastplate as he had never before imagined. The armor gleamed silver, edged in gold, and had a line of gemstones set across it.
Talmadge, who had some experience with Albelican magic, had no doubt that those stones were enchanted.
A knight, he whispered, for he could see no other explanation other than this strange man was a nobleman of high rank, or had been. The sword and the bow were clues enough, of course, but this was magnificent.
Even Talmadge, who had never seen a knight of Hans the Bear, but had heard of the famed Allheart,
understood that surely few in the world possessed such armor. He reached into the pack beside the breastplate and brought forth a small bag. He pulled back the drawstring and gently dumped the contents into his hand.
Gemstones, sparkling in the starlight.
A beautiful mix, ruby and diamond, zircon and malachite. So many, all varied. Hardly able to draw breath, Talmadge eased the stones back into the bag. Taking supreme care not to spill any, he quickly repacked the large pack and secured the flap once more, then moved back to his place at the tree, now doubly confused as to what he might do. So, he did nothing. He just waited. And waited. He woke up with the sun in his eyes, rising over the mountains before him. He blinked away the sleepiness and tried to recall where he was and why he was there. He jumped to his feet, hopping all about. Brian Marrowee was gone, and all his gear gone with him.
Bandits?
Talmadge whispered, terribly afraid. For if bandits had taken the likes of that man, what chance might Talmadge have against them? But he calmed before the notion could take root. For there, in the dirt, by the fire pit, Brian Marrowee had written him a note. I go to greet my ghosts, my new friend Talmadge. You should face your own. When you fear, charge. Talmadge stared at the words for a long while, then closed his eyes and pictured Lochpyug. An image flashed in his thoughts. A leg, severed above the knee. He took a deep breath. He hadn't been back to the loch since departing there with the spring melt after Chote's death. He had thought that he would never go there again, but now he just snorted self-deprecatingly, reminding himself that this wasn't the first time he had held such a belief. He thought of Fasach Cran, and, strangely, of Redshanks. Chote had wanted to trade the pearls with the man. She had pleaded with Talmadge constantly to reconsider. What a fine adventure they could have in collecting the pearls from the tribes, then travelling halfway around the known world, to deliver them for Redshanks, to his friends in the city on the river. Talmadge couldn't remember its name. Talmadge took another deep breath and held perfectly silent, listening to the roll of the distant river. Gradually, a smile came over him, a smile for Chote and the thick book she had written. Not unlike Brian Marrowee's mother, he supposed, and quite like Brian himself, he was sure. That notion didn't shame him, but, strangely, urged him. For you, my love, Talmadge said, and decided. As bold a choice as he had ever made. He would write those pages Chote had desired, for her. He checked his gear and took up his hand axe, that he could cut some logs and build a raft. Inava and Anise both winced when the screams at last died away, only to be replaced by sounds of the poor young girl being beaten and chastised, with Kaya screaming at her for being stupid.
You dare to not drink the potions, she roared, and slapped the young girl again.
I did,
the Uma sobbed, her words becoming muddled under a rain of blows. They didn't hear the young slave cry out any more, though, as if she had no more tears to give.
She did drink the brew, Anise whispered to Inava. I saw her take it, and spoke with her long about it. You don't want to fear an Uskar child, I told her. She knew the punishment.
Inava nodded, having no trouble believing Anissa's story. The Umas were all taught the consequences of getting pregnant, and were given potions from the witches they were told prevented such unfortunate circumstances. But those brews weren't always efficacious, Inava knew from first-hand experience. Twice in her long years as a slave, she had become pregnant from an Uskar warrior, only to have her pregnancy so violently ended by the cold magic of an Uskar witch. She feared the latest batch of brew was likely bad, Minerva knew. Her hand going to her belly. She moved it away as soon as she was aware of the reflexive movement, not wanting Anise to worry.
You should go to her,
Minerva said, when at last the beating and berating died away. Anise nodded and crawled out of the small tree cave. Minerva took a deep, steadying breath while watching her go. As soon as she was alone, she moved to the back of her little room and moved aside some branches to let some moonlight and starlight shine in on a particular spot. She brushed aside the pine needles, revealing a thick, flat stone. She needed another deep breath, then lifted the front of the stone, revealing a deep hole Minerva had secretly dug. The moonlight brushed the side wall, mostly stone, and just touched the treasure Minerva had caught. She watched it coil and slide, a white-furred mountain viper. It was a small one, about as long as Inova's forearm, and nearly as thick. Inova had come upon it purely by accident a few days earlier, sunning itself on the rocky ledge behind the pine grove. She should have crushed it with a rock, for these aggressive vipers were quite deadly. But she hadn't. For some reason, Inova had chosen to catch the thing with a blanket, and had dumped it into her secret hole. She hadn't understood why, at the time. At least not consciously. But after hearing the screams of the poor girl down the way, Inova knew what instincts had guided her actions. She simply couldn't take it any longer. The years had broken her. The Uskar had battered her. She knew she would soon be killed anyway, because she was into her 40s now, and the Uskar warriors preferred the younger slaves for their visits. In the end, that was the only reason any of the female Umas were kept alive, and Inova was outliving her usefulness. Why give them pleasure, or the sacrifice to their demon god? The woman slowly slipped one hand into the opening. One bite, she knew. It would only take one bite, and she would probably be dead before morning, before the Uskar found her. Even if they came upon her before she succumbed, there was nothing the witches could do against the poison of a white-furred viper. Their magic would not defeat this poison. She should have done this, thrown herself from a cliff or something. Years ago, she scolded herself, inching her hands down a bit more. But no, she had stayed alive for a reason. She had even learned to better pleasure the Uskar warriors. For a reason. Because she had a son, and he was still alive. Aulan had assured her that Budlan was well, and that Inova would see him again, when they broke the summer camp and returned to the winter plateau. Inova heard the snake hiss and yanked her hand back. She closed the stone and stepped away, bringing her hand to her mouth in a silent scream.
Budlan was still alive.
She desperately wanted to see him again one time. She brushed the pine needles back over her secret cubby, silently chastising herself for even thinking of taking her own life, before she had the chance to say farewell to her beloved son. Before she moved back to the tree trunk to fall asleep, though, she put her hand to her belly and remembered again the screams of the poor girl, and, in the quiet of the evening, she could hear the girl softly sobbing. Inova went to the tree, shaking her head determinedly, but she did glance back more than once, considering the bite of a serpent. 29. Pierced. Aulan closed her eyes to protect them from flying shards, and brought the heavy stone down hard on the crystalline cylinder, shattering it into a million pieces.
Heresy, she whispered, as if in warning to herself.
She called upon the large diamond-flecked crystal near her, and brightened the light, as she sifted through the dust and shards to find the desired gemstone. A garnet, and a powerful one. The stones she was now collecting were all powerful, for Aulan could sense their relative strength by holding the crystals and concentrating on them. She could also use garnet. She had found that the stone allowed her to see magic. This one was much stronger than the one she had used to find it, so she was excited about what it would show her in these miraculous crystal caverns. She wasn't about to waste her time with stones of trivial size if she could find larger, more powerful ones. She put the garnet near the pile of nearly a dozen gems and minerals she had already collected. Most of her time in the crystal caverns had been spent identifying the various stones encased within the crystals. With each one she recognized as magical and different, Aulan sought out the specific properties, then searched until she found one of suitable power to be worthy of her heresy. For yes, that's what this was, she knew, and knew too that she'd get terribly punished, perhaps even killed, if discovered. But this was too beautiful, and so it was a chance Aulan was willing to take. She knew that she had to be discreet, but there were only so many places to hide the gemstones, and she didn't want to simply bag them. No, she wanted them upon her body, a part of herself through the threading she had learned with the Wedstones. Weirdly, Merin had inadvertently shown Aulan a way to do this, instructing the young woman in another typically mundane task. The tribe made jewelry with pretty mundane stones, and gold coins taken from the lakemen. They were pretty, and it was not forbidden for the women of Uskar to wear jewelry fashioned of them. And that Merin had shown her and Gavino, a rival of hers for entrance to the coven, was at least 10 years Aulan senior.
Using a milky white crystal thick with serpentine and one ruby-flecked, Merin had enacted the same fire shield that allowed her to walk out of a bonfire unharmed, then had taken up a golden coin and used the ruby to create a blast of fire all about her, greatly softening the gold.
While still using the serpentine shield, Merin's hands had then worked fast to fashion the substance into a brooch, and had even set a gemstone in it for good measure. Aulan had her answer, and thus she had begun wearing jewelry just a few days previous, and had even shaped a ring in front of Gavino. She'd already melted that ring again to remove the worthless gemstone, and down here she had created one anew, setting it with a magical serpentine and ruby, and molding it around that Wedstone wire with just enough sticking out inside the band so that she could puncture her finger and heal the wound around with wire, in effect, piercing the ring to her finger. She would never need Merin's scepter to create a bonfire, she thought, as she felt the pinch of the wire when she had first put it on. Nay, she would be her own scepter, and more. With this new insight, with the gems and minerals instead of the bulky crystals, and with Wedstone binding them to her physical form, Aulan believed that she would become a being of pure magic, a woman truly worthy of Uskar. What next? She wondered. She thought to go deeper into the caverns, to see if she could identify some new types of magical stones, but she dismissed the notion quickly. She had gotten too late a start. Besides, there was something else she had to do. Gavina had taken note of the other ring Aulan had fashioned, the moonstone and malachite ring that allowed her to fly about the mountainside free of earthly bonds. She took up the ring now, and broke it apart with the heavy rock, retrieving the malachite and the Wedstone wire from the broken moonstone band. She had already found another moonstone, a pretty blue-white ball. It was quite small, but very powerful, Aulan knew. She had plans for this stone, and the malachite, and she didn't have much time. She put the fine Wedstone thread aside, and took up a different one she had fashioned with great care. Not just a simple wire. This one itself was ornamental. Wire wrapped over wire to form a cascading series of tiny diamond shapes, Four strands of these of varying lengths, the longest as long as Owlin's middle finger, the shortest half that length, flowed out from a circular grey whetstone hub, like the fronds of a willow tree. Owlin took up her graphite bar and selected four gemstones. The diamond she had just retrieved, the smooth round malachite striped in varying green hues, the new moonstone, and the beautiful purple dolomite.
One by one she put the gemstones to the end of a strand, squeezing them into the diamond-shaped wire mound, then flipping the last link over to squeeze them into the previous diamond-shaped wire, securing them on all sides.
Not satisfied with that, and shuddering at the thought of losing the moonstone and malachite in the middle of a flight down the mountain, Owlin then protected herself with the serpentine in her ring, and created sparks of lightning about the setting with her graphite bar. She giggled as each setting softened temporarily, just long enough for her to squeeze it tightly onto the gemstone.
When she was done, she laid the small earring out on the floor before her, admiring it, and also very afraid of what she would do next, for it was purely her idea, and something she had never before heard of.
With trembling hands, she picked up the whetstone hub and fiddled with the two points of wire sticking out its flat side. The serpentine wouldn't help her with this part, and she knew it was going to hurt.
Owlin lifted up her shirt and hunched over, lining up the longer wire.
She closed her eyes, bit down on her lip to stifle any scream, and pushed it through, piercing her belly button. She resisted calling upon the whetstone then, for she knew the worst was yet to come. As she brought the threaded wire against the other prong, twisted them together, and pushed them both into her belly, so that the whetstone hub was flat. And she shot herself with the lightning, and a thousand fires erupted inside her. Owlin nearly swooned from the pain, but managed to call upon the whetstone, filling herself with its healing wash. Warm waves of magic knit together her skin, closing tight about the wire prongs, securing the belly ring.
When the process was completed, it felt as if it was merely an extension of Owlin herself.
She stood up, admiring her work and focusing, concentrating deeply on the stones. Yes, she could toughen herself with the dolomite, strengthen her body against blows and make herself immune to pain, poison, or disease. That dangling purple stone gave her health. She could fly, and she could float, could create brilliant light, or steal all of it away. She could create fireballs, and protect herself from their burn. And, most important of all, she was wedded to the whetstone, so Owlin could heal any of her wounds.
The young woman's giggle turned into sobs, so proud was she of what she had accomplished here in this cave, of how she had taken the song of Uskar and made it her own in so many varied and beautiful ways.
And she wasn't done yet. Yes, she remembered this pain, like little shocks of fire tearing through her belly, burning and biting. It hurt worse than poor Inova remembered, far worse. But she figured that was mostly because Kaya was administering the medicine. How this one took pleasure in hurting the Umas. And likely, Inova knew, because the warrior who had claimed her as a wife was here all the time, taking his pleasure with the slave women. It was possible that this baby Kaya was destroying was her husband's. Inova couldn't be sure, and hardly cared. It ended with a bloody rush, and Inova nearly fainted, overcome by the dramatic shift in her entire being. She lay back, panting, trying to find some measure of balance and calm.
Kaya zapped her belly again with that nasty crystal, hard enough to burn skin, and when Inova cried out, the Uskar woman slapped her hard across the face.
"Are you too stupid to drink the brew?" Kaya demanded.
Inova had heard it all before, when Kaya had been issuing her brutal abortion to the young poor girl down the line. Inova wanted to respond, to tell the idiot Uskar that no Umas would become pregnant by choice here. That batch of the contraceptive brew had clearly been ineffective. The middle-aged woman was too smart to bother, though. Such words would just get her slapped again, and probably shocked again for good measure. It didn't matter how or why it had happened. Not to Kaya, certainly. So Inova just rested back and closed her eyes, pretending to faint away. Kaya slapped her again.
"Look at you,"
the Uskar witch taunted.
"Old and drawn, shriveled like a grape left on the vine."
She spat into Inova's face.
"Why would any even want you? But it's less now, to be sure, and will grow to nothing."
"Or might it won't?
Might that you'll find the gorge this winter, eh? It's past time for it, don't you think?
They'll throw you in and let your stupid boy watch.
Ha! If he's even up there. Words that he died, that the fossa got him and ate him bits at a time, slowly, so he felt all the pain."
"Why would..."
Inova screamed, sitting up, or trying to, until a blast from Kaya's grey graphite stole all of Inova's muscle control, threw her back to the floor, and left her jolting and shaking, limbs flying wildly out of her control. Laughing, Kaya and the Uskar guards departed. When her sensibilities returned, poor Inova managed to turn her head toward the back of her small pine cave, toward the buried stone lid. She should have let the snake take her, she told herself more than once, more than 100 times, until sleep, mercifully, overtook her. Aulin exited the crystal caves from the same tunnel she had first been brought to in this place. She knew the area here fairly well now, so it was with complete confidence that she leaped away, drawing the power of the green and blue-white stones dangling from the chains of wedstone, now secure to her stomach. Up she soared to the first ledge, where she set her foot again and leaped away, scaling the rocky mountain with practiced ease. She soon crossed the level of the Uskar winter encampment, and the circular grove of short pines that surrounded the god crystal. Normally, she would circle far to the left now, down and around below the encampment, and out of sight of Elder Raybert, that she could approach Badlan at work on the way from the north side of the mountain. This night, Aulin felt particularly empowered, though, and close to Uskar. She had become the god's instrument. She ran swiftly to the pines, and bounded over them with one single leap, landing in the circular lee, and stumbling forward from her momentum, nearly colliding with the god crystal. She could feel the heat pulsating from it, not uncomfortably hot, but soothingly warm. She had no idea what she was doing here, but on impulse, she reached out and touched the giant crystal. It was humming, full of Uskar's song, vibrating with swift notes. Aulin's eyes widened. She had never felt anything quite like this. She moved closer and touched it with her other hand, too, and felt the thrum of the god crystal filling her entire being, warming her, exciting her. She backed away some time later, her black eyes sparkling in crystalline reflection, her breath coming in gasps, and truly, she thought this the best night of her life. But now she had to be careful, she reminded herself, for she was not far from Raybert, and would cross near to the southern end of that camp to get to the way. She went out the southern end of the grove, putting the trees between her and the elder. With a great leap and flight, she went to the wall she had scaled with Shona that long-ago day, when she had been pledged to Breath. Now buoyed by the magic of the greenstone, Aulin scrambled spider-like across the cliff-facing, then up and over it farther along to the east, coming over a ridge in clear sight of Kresa Dyth. Past it, she descended the way carefully, smiling when she heard the tap-tap of Badlan's hammer. She found him fitting a stone. "Wouldn't it be easier to work in the daylight?" she asked, startling him, for with the green gem she walked without a whisper of sound. But Lan jumped back and raised his hammer defensively, but then smiled and lowered it when he recognized Alan.
"It is cooler at night," he replied.
"But the wolves are out at night.
They won't come this high."
"How could you know that?"
Alan asked.
"Because there's nothing big up here worth eating," he said.
Alan found herself charmed by his reasoning, by his intelligence, by the simple clarity and cadence of his speech. There was nothing simple about Redlan, but how brilliantly he had played the role of idiot, as his mother had commanded, and that, too, she knew, was a testament to his cunning.
"There's you,"
Alan counted, and Redlan had to laugh at that, and such an infectious giggle it was that Alan, too, was laughing.
"Shh," she warned.
"Shh," he warned back at her. Alan composed herself. They weren't far enough from Elder Raybert for such outbursts.
"And a wolf would find you a fine meal," she said,
and she pinched Badland's thick arm,
and was shocked at how solid it was.
"Is that why you fatten me up?" Badlan teased.
"You just said that the wolves don't come up here."
"Ah, but the bears do."
Alan started to laugh, but bit it back when she realized that he wasn't joking.
"They do," Redlan confirmed. "Big ones. I hear the little rock slides when they paw about. They come up to lick the moths off the stones."
"What?"
Alan couldn't tell if he was being serious or not.
"They do," he insisted. "I've seen them. The moths sleep on the warm stones, and the bears sit by, licking the stones clean."
He pointed to the east, to a spot where the ground fell away from the way steeply, affording a wide view of Fearach Buer's higher slopes.
"I can see them from there, but they don't come very close."
He paused and looked at her slyly.
"Of course, if you keep fattening me up."
Alan appreciated the levity. Taking the cue, she pulled her pack off her back and drew back the string, revealing a heaping portion of venison she had collected after dinner.
"A good bit this night," she told him proudly.
Badlan nodded, but a cloud passed over his face.
"What?"
Alan asked.
"Less food and an earlier greeting would please me more," he explained. "I would take any word you speak over any morsel of food."
Alan stared at him, her heart breaking. How lonely he must be, of course. He was up here all day, every day. Quite certainly exiled and alone.
"Why don't you run?" she asked suddenly.
"I run up and down the way often."
"I mean, away. Why don't you run away? They wouldn't even know you were gone for..."
"The old man comes here every day."
"You'd still have the whole of the night to get away," Alan said.
"They would torture my mother."
"They've promised me."
Alan winced and fell back a step.
Of course they had.
Of course the Uskar had levied such weight onto Badlan's shoulders before leaving him up here to do his miserable work. Work that would have likely killed him already, if she hadn't been bringing him food and healing his many cuts and wounds, some of which were already pus-filled by the time she put the whetstone to them. Badlan was wearing bonds of guilt and responsibility that were every bit as thick and taut as the ropes often used to bind the slaves in the camp.
Uskar did this. She was Uskar. Suddenly, Aulan wanted to be far from that place.
"In the middle of the 9th month, Esabal will show her bloody face,"
Teolik told a trio of young warriors. Agmor, Ralid, and his nephew, Aegard.
"So says the Uskarigin."
"We will raid the Lakemen at the end without worry, then,"
Ralid reasoned. But Teolig shook his head.
"At the beginning," Teolig explained, "and secretly, without the blessing of the coven."
That got the attention of the three. Teolig had summoned them specifically, and to an out-of-the-way place. And so they had all been suspicious that something was afoot. This revelation, though, was far more extreme than any had considered. They had whispered among themselves that perhaps the Uskar Lauch meant to participate in this season's raiding, or that he would name Argmor as the raid leader. But was something beyond? Teolig saw.